From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Around this time each summer, I look forward to the onslaught of fresh tomatoes, while at the same time hoping against hope that what I call tomato troubles don't reveal themselves and get the upper hand. I've been hearing from lots of readers and listeners in recent weeks that the new normal of weather chaos nationwide and worldwide isn't helping them get to the tomato finish line successfully, and that they're worried. So with all that in mind, I made my annual frantic call with some urgent tomato questions to today's guest, Craig LaHoulier in North Carolina, the NC Tomato Man, as he's known on social media, author of the classic book, Epic Tomatoes. Craig knows more about these cherished fruits than almost anyone I've ever met, and he even shares that in live sessions each week on his Instagram account, where you can ask your questions and get solid answers. I asked Craig how he's doing and what we should all be doing to bolster a bountiful harvest, and also about which fruits to save next year's seed from anyhow, and other tomato questions. Hey, Craig, how are you?
Hi, how are you? It's just wonderful to be here chatting with you. And it's so timely because today I went out and actually harvested the first actual non-blossom end rot induced ripened perfect tomatoes for my garden. So we're late. We're about 2 or 3 weeks later than usual here.
Whoa, okay. Well, before we get started with our complaints and our success stories, I should say we'll have a book giveaway of Epic Tomatoes with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com, and which people always love. It's a great book. And so I was going to ask you, how's the harvest in Hendersonville, North Carolina? So now you said something about blossom end rot, and I saw that on Instagram. You had some sort of deformed looking tomatoes going on there.
Yeah, I don't know if I should be alarmed or charmed, but people seem to love it when I show them my problems. And, you know, having been a gardener for 40 years, I think it's really important to make it clear that there is no perfect garden. There is no perfect season. We just have things we deal with. But by and large, if we do the right things, you know, things come out pretty well. So we're just starting. We had a relatively cool, wet spring, which meant the seedlings didn't really progress visually. I'm sure the roots did really well, but they didn't look like they were doing a whole lot. So everything got in the ground a week and a half later. Here's an interesting marker is Saturday was Hendersonville's tomato day. And I actually had to back out because you can't have tomato day when you have not a single tomato to taste. So, people try to get the right date for these big events.
Sure.
And anytime people are trying to time a gardening event, gardening as a whole can fool us. And it just did this year by making it a very late season, relatively.
Well, and it's not just tomatoes, Craig. I mean, yesterday I heard from a friend near me where usually the fall Japanese anemones bloom in August, who has already had them for a week in her garden. And I think my oak leaf hydrangeas came about 2-3 weeks early this year, and, you know, on and on and on. So, I mean, a lot of differences in this aberrant, you know, new normal thing that's going on. So,
yeah. Do you think our attention is trying to be gotten a little bit? You know, my wife and I love to grow all kinds of flowers, and I agree watching how our various perennials and flowering shrubs did or even didn't bloom this year has been very, very instructional on how they feel about all of this.
Right. Well, where I am up in the Hudson Valley of New York, you know, fruit growing is one of the important farming things that goes on here. And all the cherries and peaches and even a lot of the apples were lost in a very late, very hard freeze and so forth. And I mean, I think tomatoes are coming in, but we've had loads of crazy rain and humidity. And I know farmers and gardeners around me, and maybe around you too, are worried about fungal issues, you know, things like you and I talked about last year around this time when I made my frantic call. you know, it's like, and I'll link to that fuller conversation, but just sort of the basic rundown by this time in your summer, when you're trying to stay ahead of the problems, what's the basic protocol, sort of the cheat sheet version of it that you're doing? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think first of all, I learned something, even after all of those decades of gardening, I learned something every year because I observe and then I put my thinking cap on and I try to make sense of what I see. So I got a lot of questions this year from people saying, my tomatoes are blossoming really, really well, but some of those flowers are falling off. So I developed this theory that the plant kind of knows what it's doing. And if you have a plant with 100 flowers on it, they're not all going to form, because you can't have 100 pounds of 1 pound tomatoes
right.
on a plant. So the plant knows that it's doing too much. So
self-thinning, right? Isn't
it? It is
self-thinning.
Yep. Yes. It is. Yes. It is aborting flowers because yes. it's decided, given what I'm being watered and given what I'm being fed, this is more than I can handle. So I eased a lot of people's minds on that. So everybody's okay. kind of keeping an eye on that. However, you brought up an interesting point, because even though a season may start late in terms of harvest, humidity doesn't wait, rain doesn't wait, especially no. wet foliage that sits overnight. And so you do get the inevitable fungal issues. And, you know, people send me a picture of a leaf that has a little blemish on it, and they're really worried about it. And I'm like, oh, get in line.
You ain't seen nothing yet.
That is one leaf. So anybody the world over that grows tomatoes in warm, humid areas will have septoria leaf spot. They'll have early blight. They may have both on the same leaf. The control of that, which brings me to my other point, we get warm, we get tired. So the best gardens you can have are when you find the wherewithal within yourself to go out on that hot, steamy day with your scissors in your bucket and get the ugly foliage off the plant, or go out at noon when it's 95 degrees and realize your plant's wilting. I have to get water on it because it's going to stress. If that plant stresses, I'm going to get blossom end rot. So these are the times that try tomato growers' stamina and
yes.
focus. And, you know, being 67 now, I feel differently than I did when I first gardened. When I was 27, I sometimes don't have that reserve, that energy, and the air-conditioned house and the couch calling, take a nap, Craig, it's a warm afternoon, it's nice in here. So what I do is I pay the price, and the fungus on the foliage has one additional day or two additional days to spread onto additional plants. So there is a cause and effect with this. And the more engaged you can keep yourself, the more stamina you can find, the more resolve you can get in there daily and spot where those problems are. And maybe it's the little hornworm that's a half an inch long today, and it's 3 inches long and has eaten one quarter of your plant tomorrow. So there's a lot to be said for energetically and gardening like you really mean it, and not
so
just, you know,
right.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, so it's the long game, you're saying, that we
yeah.
have to play the long game, and we have to, hygiene is key, especially as we
right.
get into this humid with these older, you know, these plants that are already under the load of trying to reproduce to make the fruit, ripen the fruit. We need to keep the nasty infected stuff and the 3 inch long hornworms
yeah.
off them,
hornworm.
Right? We have to give
yeah.
them a break, right?
And,
yeah.
and it's when the plants have grown that you start realizing that you've created pools of shade. And so I've got plants that are dwarfs and grow bags that are being shaded by indeterminates. So I know that those are the plants that are going to give me the biggest trouble with fungal diseases. Sun is a marvelous disinfectant. If you could get air
okay.
blowing through your plant, if you could get sun shining on your leaves all the time, you would really minimize those fungal infections. But the back of the plant, the interior of the plant, the low foliage does end up getting shaded as the plants grow. And so I'm already thinking design differences for my plants next year, more adequate spacing, more
okay.
adequate choreography of which types of plants are going to be where, so I'm not shading other parts of my garden. So I guess what I'm saying, it's never too late to start planning for next year, which is the importance of a log, or in my case, a blog or Instagram Live, which
right.
is...
Right.
That's a garden log for me. I can go back over an entire season, and if I so choose to, you know, bore myself with myself, I can watch what are the things that I talked about on particular dates that I told myself I need to be careful to watch out for this
yes.
next year. And,
yes.
You know, gardening is an exercise in continuous improvement, and that continuous improvement actually lasts a lifetime, or all of the years that you're going to grow a garden. And that makes
yeah.
it really fun, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, we all want what we're really seeking are ripe tomatoes. So
yes.
at what stage Does Craig actually pick from the vines? What do you
Yeah.
consider the moment? Because, some people wait until it's fully ripe and,
Right.
oh, I can eat it out of hand right standing in the row. And some
Yeah.
people pick at a less developed, and then there's at the end of the season when, especially up
Sure.
north, when frost is threatening and, we might
Yeah.
have a lot. So what's your strategy for when to pick?
This has evolved over the years, and a lot of the evolution has been my interactions with Joe Lample, where we've put our heads
Oh,
together and thought about that as
Joe.
well. Yeah, Joe, he's.
Now, and we should just say you, Joe Lample, joegardner.com,
Yep,
and you've
yep.
done a whole tomato course
Yeah,
that you guys
yeah.
do together the last few years, and it's very
Right.
popular. Yeah.
And what was great about that is we learned from each other and we learned collectively as a twosome because we would talk over things and change our methods. But
Yes.
I've become a breaker stage picker, meaning in if anybody watches the little 1 minute reel that I put on Instagram today, I actually show my very first picking. They're laying on the counter and they're only about one third to one half ripe. Why did I do that? Because we get these heavy thunderstorms and I'm watering regularly. And there's no better way to crack a tomato than to let it get fully ripe and then have it water applied to it, either by nature or by us. And the tomato just can't handle it. It swells and the
The
skin
skin,
cracks. The skin just
right.
cracks. The other thing is, I don't know if anything is more tempting to critters in your garden than the smell of an absolutely fully vine-ripe tomato. So you can also minimize pest and critter damages if you get them off the plant a little bit earlier. And another fringe benefit is I have found that the shelf life of tomato that's ripened more slowly indoors lasts a little bit more. Very few things are more perishable than an absolutely dead ripe picked tomato. You bring it in the house, and within a day or two, it's already melting on the shelf
Right,
into a puddle
right,
of nasty smelling stuff.
right.
So, the fruit
Okay.
flies know exactly. So yeah, and Joe and I have both done this test. Once you let it ripen indoors on your kitchen counter over a few days, the taste becomes totally indistinguishable between that shelf ripened tomato
Yes.
picked a little bit early and the fully vine ripe. And sometimes the taste is a little better because a fully vine ripe tomato can actually be a little bit overripe. And when a tomato gets overripe, the flavor flattens out. You lose some of the sparky sense of tingly acidity to it, and you just can get like a flat, funky flavor out of it. So yeah, these are things I've just learned the last 3, 4, or 5 years as a new best practice. And
Yeah,
when they start coming, I pick 6 or 8 tomatoes, and I've probably got hundreds out there. So the other thing to have in mind is your strategy for dealing with the whole ocean of tomatoes that will flow in way too close together to each other. So get your
Right, of
canning
course,
jars, get
of
your
course.
lids, get your bands, get your freezer bags, get your recipes, and get your friends so you can, give them
Well,
away, hold a tasting, all of those things.
at the beginning of that answer, you said something. You said you pick at the breaker stage. And I
Yeah.
think it's fun for people. And with the transcript of the show, I'll show the illustration from, I believe it's the USDA. It's like a vintage
Yeah.
illustration that I have. They name and they show you color pictures of the different phases of ripening. And you have to get to a certain point or it can't ripen off the vine. Like if you pick a solid green tomato, it's not going to ripen on the kitchen counter. It's got to be at least at that, I believe, at the breaker or something stage. So explain that real quick.
Yeah. Well, so the first thing is if you pick a fully sized green tomato and you bring it in and put it near an apple or banana, the ethylene given off will actually ripen it to the point where it won't be the best tomato of that type you ever ate, but the seeds are actually viable for seed saving
Okay.
inside. So at the end of the season, if you find yourself loaded with green fruit, you haven't done your seed saving yet, don't worry. Bring them in, put them in a big paper bag, make sure you label them, put a ripe apple or banana in with them. Within a few weeks, you'll have ripe tomatoes with viable seed that you can either
Fully
use.
developed green fruit, you said though, right?
As long as now the tricky part of the breaker stage is we now have tomatoes in an array of colors. So this is where learning comes in. What does a pink tomato look like at breaker stage? What is a purple, a brown, a red? And the most difficult one of all to pick at breaker stage is the ones that are green when ripe, because they barely change color even when fully ripe. So that's when you need to do kind of the Charmin squeeze test on the base of the tomato. If it starts giving just a little bit, you don't want to dent it and bruise the flesh. But you can practice. You can go up to the plant and look at some really hard green tomatoes and see what they're like when you gently squeeze them. And then go and gently squeeze a ripe tomato, and you can educate your fingers to know what to squeeze for, and that will help. And when the USDA did that, there probably just were red tomatoes at the time. So we're having to they need to redo their antique
That
color chart,
illustration.
right?
But the idea being that, generally speaking, what you said at the very beginning, don't wait until it's fully ripe on the vine. That's not, but and you can be sure if it's coloring up a little bit, you can bring it in and do the kitchen counter
Absolutely.
thing.
And here's the other interesting thing. Tomatoes tend to ripen from the inside out. So even if a tomato looks fully green on the outside, if it's getting to the point where it's going to start to show color on the outside, if you cut it in half, you'll see a core of pretty well-colored fruit. And that's how grocery stores get away from calling tomatoes vine ripened. They're actually picked when just there's a teeny bit of color in the center, and they're gassed with ethylene, and that's to give them shelf life. But unfortunately, that does not give them edible texture and flavor. So, only home gardeners really, and people who buy at farmers markets have learned to appreciate the absolute joy of a homegrown tomato versus a grocery store tomato.
Well, you mentioned seed saving and that we could save seed from these fully developed green tomatoes that then we ripened in the bag with the ethylene off-gassing other fruit and so on and so forth. So, but I was really surprised, and I had to, of course, as soon as I thought it through, I was like, oh, right, of course. The other day on social media, on your Instagram account at NC Tomato Man, you showed some really, I don't know, they were like, they looked like multiple tomatoes glued together. They were like these incredibly misshapen tomatoes, and then also some with what you were talking about earlier, blossom end rot or BER. And you were saying you could save the seeds from those. And I was like, well, no, we want to save it from the. And then I thought, no, Margaret, of course that's okay because those are sort of like they're abiotic issues. They're mechanical failures. They're caused by something. They're not pathogens. They're not diseases,
I
right?
know.
And
Now,
right.
wasn't that a show of self-confidence on my part that my first tomatoes I would show would be like as ugly as sin? But I'm
I've never
thinking,
seen anything quite like one of those.
I know. But here's the point. There are certain things, so cracks, variable sizes, blossom end rot, really do fall under the umbrella of physiological issues, meaning they're caused by growing conditions, whether it's temperature at the time. But all of the seeds of a particular tomato plant. So let's say you've got, I don't know, a Cherokee purple, 25 tomatoes on them on that one plant. Some are cat phase, some are ugly. The genetic material in every seed and every fruit on that plant is identical. So, and this was the great brainstorm that Alexander Livingston came up in 1870, where he was watching seed companies trying to improve tomatoes by saving seed from only the perfect fruit, and then the next year getting the same mix of cat-faced and ugly. So what he did is learned you have to plant 1,000 plants of a particular variety and look for the single plant, whereas all of the tomatoes on that plant are showing a distinct improvement, which indicates genetic difference. And he
I
all
see.
and all of his new tomatoes were based on what he calls single plant selection. He was looking for the one or two superior plants in a field of thousands to base his future tomato developments on. And that revolutionized all of tomato growing. But it didn't stick, because if you look at old seed catalogs, you would still see you have to pay extra for the seed because we saved it from the first perfect melon of the plant. I'm like, big deal. You don't have to charge extra for that. But, that was their form of advertising and kind of pulling one over on the public so they could charge more for certain types of seeds. We know better now that the seed business is filled with hyperbole and exaggeration, and now we use Photoshop and filters to make everything look so much more perfect than we can grow ourselves. That's really why I like to put my ugly, misshapen, funny looking tomatoes on, because I always want to be a real gardener for
Yeah,
people,
and so like one of the ones that you showed, and we can show the picture with the transcript of the show. Like again, it looked like almost like two or three tomatoes stuck together. So what happens that makes that kind of multi-lobed, crazy looking? What does that? Is that multiple flower? What goes on? What goes on there?
So what you have there is a lot of the larger fruited heirloom beefsteaks, the initial flower on clusters. I like to call them marigold flowers. They're really large and they've got so many petals inside. And it's just a genetic characteristic of the large beefsteaks to have every so often they'll throw a flower with that complexity. It's kind of a fused blossom. It's several flowers fused into one. So if by chance you get a tomato that forms on a flower like that, often they abort because it's very difficult for pollination to occur in those types of flowers. But if they do form, you get the multi-lobed, ugly fruta from it. And a lot of times temperature when fruit setting can also affect the success of even pollination. You can get some funny looking ones. What really frustrates people is when they pick a tomato that is multi-lobed and one of the lobes is dead ripe and the other lobe is totally green. And what I do in that case is I try to sever the tomato right between the two halves and put the cut part of the green one cut side down in a plate to try to minimize the amount of oxygen getting in, hoping that it will catch up and ripen a little bit later than I can eat it. But usually I'll just cut away the fully ripe part and enjoy it, and just, you know, the other half that's green, I may toss it or I may wait till it ripens a little bit and just use it for seed saving. But we see a lot of that early in the season. We see a lot of blossom end rot earlier in the season because the plants are being called on to do so much. Here comes perfect weather. Here comes all this nutrition and the watering and, ooh, I've got leaves and stems and flowers and I'm pollinating. And the plant just gets a little overwhelmed. It interrupts the calcium flow into the fruit. That deficit is what causes the blossom end rot. So just a little bit of patience, getting through those first one or two ugly fruit in a plant, and usually blossom end rot goes away all by itself without having to cram a lot of calcium into the soil.
So we have maybe 3 minutes left or so. And I just wanted to say, so you were talking about seed saving, and you, I think also on Instagram, you might've mentioned recently something that I hadn't thought about, which is that I think you save seed from early crops having something to do with the bee population or something. Yeah. Tell us about that.
So usually early in the season, when you still have relatively cool nights, the bees either haven't shown up in any kind of numbers yet, or they're off on basil and spring flowers. so they're leaving your tomatoes alone, which is really, really good. And this is something I think people need to understand, because they'll say, I'm really depressed about the bee population in my yard. I'm afraid I won't get any tomatoes. Tomatoes are perfect flowered, meaning they pollinate upon opening. They don't really need the bees to help in any way. The bees, in fact, will cause problems later in the season by dragging pollen from a neighboring variety onto the flower. And if you save the seed from that fruit, you'll get interesting things. So I like to use the first one or two clusters low down in the plant prior to the bees showing up in numbers. And I tend to get about 95, 96, up to 98% purity of those first safe seeds. And as a seed saver, that really is convenient, because then you're not having to go out and bag blossom clusters with wood twill or, you know, like a real thin fabric bag before they open, and then let them pollinate. That's a good way to do it. But I get a little bit lazier in my old age, and I want to let nature and cleverness dictate how I do my seed saving.
Do you squeeze the seed out of the tomatoes and ferment it in a little water, or what's your prep?
Yeah. So if a tomato is very ripe and juicy, usually just squeezing the seeds into the cup gives you sufficient liquid to where you swirl the cup. And it's not a problem at all to add enough water to get it to swirl well. That does not cut down on the fermentation. Just beware that the hotter the weather, the quicker the fermentation. And in the middle of the summer, any longer than 2 or 3 days, and you're starting to actually germinate the seed that you're trying to save. So get it out there quick. So it's there's so many different hints and tips. It's an endlessly fascinating hobby that there is always more to learn. And last thing I'll say, I've got 70 plants here, 115 plants, and it is inevitable that plants are going to go down to disease. I've got one today that's got pith necrosis. It's dead as a doornail. Another with cholera, two with fusarium wilt. These things are capricious. These agents are flying around. They're landing on your foliage. They could be in the ground for the roots to pick them up. So I think my way to get around that is plant lots of plants, so that when you start losing a few, It's not devastating. Whereas if I just had a half a dozen plants and lost two of them, that's one third of my future crop.
Yes.
So it's
Absolutely.
Just a little risk. It's a risk assessment thing I take
Absolutely.
When I decide what I grow.
Well, Craig LaHoulier, we're going to, as I said, fortunately for someone, we're going to be giving away a copy of Epic Tomatoes, which tells them even more. I'm going to give the link with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. I'll give the link to your Instagram. They can join your
Great.
Instagram live the rest of the weeks of the summer and get that support that you give to all your visitors and so forth. So thank you for answering my urgent tomato question.
Well, you know, and
our
I want to mention,
annual visit.
when you call Epic Tomatoes Classic, it made me, number one, feel a little bit old, but it made
well,
me realize
I'm old
that,
too.
Well, we're all, but it's been out there for almost 9 years now, so
yep.
time has flown. Last little tidbit, I'm actually talking to my story publishing editor on Wednesday. They seem to be interested now on perhaps having me write and publish the Dwarf Tomato Project book. So
oh,
fingers,
great.
Fingers
I'll give,
crossed.
I'll give the link to that conversation that we've had too about Dwarf Tomato Project.
Yeah, right. yeah.
And I'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
Okay. And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and tomato ripening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.